Welcome to a special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. Today, we are joined by Haley Smith. She's a professional mountain biker and gravel racer, really an off-road cyclist, I guess is how we'd phrase it these days, from Ontario, Canada. And Haley is riding for the newly formed Trek Bikes Drift List team, which also has friend of the podcast, Russell Finsterwald on it. Really exciting to see a new team formed there. If you don't know who Haley is, I'm going to run through a quick intro and then we'll get things going here. But last year, Haley placed third in the Lifetime Grand Prix. She is an Olympian. She raced for Canada at the Tokyo Olympics in the XCO discipline. She's also been to the Commonwealth Games and received a World Cup bronze medal as well, and represented Canada many different times at international competitions, which is a really exciting thing. Haley's also a mental health advocate and has openly shared her journey about managing orthorexia and anxiety as a professional endurance athlete. She's a kinesiology, which is, I'm probably said that wrong. I apologize, Haley. I can never say that one right. Graduate. And also, you're currently pursuing your master's degree in sports psychology at Queen's University, focusing on healthy childhood development within the sporting environment. It's really cool to have you on. Yeah, right? I know.
That's great. Resume.
Yeah. It's really cool to have you on, Haley. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I was thrilled to be asked. I listen to this podcast a lot, so it's exciting.
That's cool. And you're being from Canada, you mentioned that you listen to us while you're on the trainer very often, right?
Yes, I do.
Lots of trainer rides. Haley, orthorexia. Some people might not know that term. Can you explain it?
Yeah, so orthorexia is actually a relatively new category of eating disorder. I'll have to give you a little bit of a backstory, but when I was 13, I went through a pretty rough time and I was diagnosed with anorexia undefined, as opposed to anorexia nervosa, because I exhibited a lot of the symptoms of anorexia, but it didn't quite fit the bill. And since that time when I was diagnosed, which was 12 years ago now, somewhere between 12 and 15 years ago, orthorexia has since been recognized by the powers that be and has been added to the diagnostic and statistical manual that lists and explains all of the various mental disorders out there. And basically what orthorexia is an obsession with healthiness, with like healthification. So it's characterized by similar habits to anorexia, such as extreme food restriction, but it's coupled with other habits like extreme over-exercising and something that we might get into, which is the healthification of food or the vilification of certain foods and a refusal to eat certain foods that are deemed to be unhealthy for whatever reason.
How does one know if they're, because so I've definitely been in the situation where I'm, I'm training and I really want to focus on the outcome. And I am so preoccupied on everything I eat, the planning, I'm weighing stuff. And it's stressful, it's sometimes it's fun, but it's fun to like get it right. But I could probably also, I don't know if I'm doing damage or not. How would one know if they fall in that category or not? I mean, I guess talk to somebody, but I bet there's a lot of people here who go, I weigh my food sometimes. I keep track of my carbs or something like that. Mm-hmm. Should I be concerned about this?
So, first of all, I will preface this with, I never have, and I don't like weigh any of my food. I don't count calories. I don't even count my macros. Like I pay literally no attention to the actual numerical side of eating. And that's because I have obviously a huge, it's a blind spot. It's a risk factor for me to do those things. Mm-hmm. So it's just not on the table for me. But the distinction is usually, if we look at eating disorders in a broad sense, there can be disordered eating. And there can be an eating disorder. And disordered eating would be habits that are like, as an outsider, you might look at and be like, I'm not sure that that's, totally healthy or good for that person, but the person can still be functional. An eating disorder is a presentation of these habits in a chronic or long-term way that seriously impacts quality of life and ability to function. So you won't, an eating disorder is something that needs to be diagnosed. It's an illness that is diagnosed by a mental health or a professional or a physician or someone like that. But I would say that if you're wondering if it's, if you're wondering if you have this, if you are experiencing this, then that's maybe a red flag to me, because that indicates that it is on some level impacting your enjoyment or your quality of life or something to that effect.
Got it.
That's really good advice. Yeah. Yeah. That's great context around the two terms that seem like, and oftentimes we might use them interchangeably, in unintentionally, not meaning to confuse them. Right. But just in conversation that you're having with somebody, it's common to hear disordered eating or eating disorders and perhaps use that way. So thanks for clarifying that. That's awesome.
Yeah, and just one more thing to add there too. So just with disordered eating, it's often something that if someone points out to you, you can recognize that as habits that you can change. But with an eating disorder, it's so deep. It's so ingrained. It's so difficult to let not, I mean, setting, changing it aside, it is incredibly difficult to even acknowledge that you have an issue. Denial is actually one of the, diagnostic criteria for many eating disorders. Mm. Anyways, I digress.
Yeah.
Which makes it so hard to get help, right? Because you think there's no issue. Yeah.
Exactly.
I like being this way. This is perfect. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A great insight. Thank you, Haley. Haley, it's funny because when I asked you to come on, I looked back through the questions thereafter once you accepted, and I found a handful of questions that I thought would be great to be able to discuss with you, considering your specific expertise. But also one of them asked specifically if we would ever have you on the podcast. So I'm really glad that we are having you on. It comes from Alyssa. And Alyssa says, would you ever consider having Haley Smith on the podcast like her? I've grown up racing XCO, and that's cross country Olympics. So typically those 90-minute races that are done on shorter lapped courses. But Alyssa says, but I think I might be getting burned out and I want to try something different. If you do, can you ask her how training for gravel is different and what she misses about cross country Olympic? This is funny because I remember the first time I actually found out who you were, Haley, I was racing, I think at Benelli or Fontana. It was one of like the Southern California races. I remember seeing you there, and I can't remember if you raced for Rocky Mountain or something like that.
Would have been Norco.
Norco, that was it. Yeah. You're racing for Norco, and I remember at the talk was like these really fast Canadian riders, and Haley Smith is here, and cross country Olympic was like it was like your identity in terms of your racing identity. But you went to Tokyo. You've done all that. You've done all these things. Was that hard to just pull up and change completely over to gravel?
Well, yes. And I would say that you can tell that it was hard because I didn't do it cold turkey. I didn't commit to it fully. After Tokyo, I was completely burned out. I actually woke up the morning of the mountain bike race in Tokyo knowing in my gut that it was the last bike race I would ever do in my life. I went through a brief period, a 2-week period where I was convinced after the Olympics that I was going to become a triathlete. And then I went for like 4 runs and I was like, oh, maybe not.
Wait till you swim.
I tried swimming too. And anyways, that's a whole nother tangent, but, it was such a huge part of my identity, and it is still to some degree. If Tokyo was in 2021, and in 2022, I still did quite a bit of XCO. I was kind of dipping my toes in gravel, and this marathon mountain bike stuff. And then the same story last year, actually. So in 2023, I think I had 25 race weekends, and at least a third of those were XCO. So this year, 2024, is actually going to be the first year that I will not do any XCO at all, which is a huge change for me. But in retrospect, that is a decision I should have had the courage to make fully heading into 2022, because trying to do both is quite difficult. And especially if you have a schedule with a lot of volume in it, a lot of races, it is a very different type of fitness, and different type of racing. And it's really difficult to be good at both within the same year, I would say.
Yeah. And thinking about it from your perspective, like me listening to this, I go to a race and I'm hoping to just like do well. And, but you're racing at the pointy end. You need to be competitive at the front of the race. So when, and that's the case, it's really difficult to just like show up with mediocre fitness and that serves both equally. You have to switch it up and really focus things. What do you miss about cross country Olympic racing? And, yeah, I guess we'll start with that.
Yeah, I miss the energy, the intensity. It doesn't relent. And certainly gravel has elements of that and marathon mountain bike does as well. But you can't keep that level of going for 12 hours. It's just not possible. So I miss that. I miss that intensity of a short track race or a cross country race. I mean, they're basically short tracks now in how short they are in the World Cup. But yeah, I'd have to say it's just the intensity.
Yeah.
How's the pain different between the two? Like what's more painful, do you think? I know there's sharper pain, but what is more painful overall?
I've had this debate with a few people, including myself. I've debated this with myself on many solo bike rides, but I'd say that they're equally painful if you're going for the win. If you're really, really contesting that front end of the race in gravel or in marathon mountain bike, you certainly have large periods of time where you're in the absolute red zone. My strongest race from last year was the BWR Canada stop on Vancouver Island. And I think I spent something like an hour in VO2 and an hour in anaerobic. Like the power numbers are insane. They're just obviously spread out over a very long period of time. Yeah. So long answer, I think that they can both be equally painful, but you can't just finish an XCO race because you'll get pulled, but you can, you know, do 80% of your potential at a gravel race and still finish. So there's more bandwidth or there's a greater spectrum of the effort that is possible to give forth and still be, you know, like achieving a goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Has your pre-race nutrition changed between XCO or like the days leading up versus gravel?
It hasn't changed enough yet. I really struggle with, this is something that I still really struggle with. It's difficult for me to eat a lot, mentally, emotionally. It's a difficult thing for me. And in XCO, that's less of an issue. Obviously, the races are only 90 minutes. And with Unbound, for example, if you have not, you know, loaded up a little bit, you're not going to get through it. So my nutrition should have changed more than it has. But like I said earlier in this chat, I don't measure macros. I don't count them. It's just not something that I have the emotional capacity to be super analytical about because I am very type A with it and it's not conducive to health for me. That being said, I definitely eat more now. I have to eat more in order to survive what I'm doing. But I couldn't share numbers with you or anything like that because I don't know them.
I think just the idea that it's okay and like these longer races, you should eat more. And I think so many people listening have that same thing. I've done it the day before. You're like, but I'm going to gain like some weight. Like I'm going to gain a pound or two. And you know, that's like $3,000 of equipment right there. And why would I want to start the race $3,000 in the hole if I, you know, drink some water and eat all these carbs to turn into glycogen? And there's always like, even when I just focus on lifting weights, I go bulk and like 3 days in, I like touch my stomach. I'm like, I'm cutting. Like I go right back, you know, and it's this cycle that you can get into where you never fully commit. And then it's hard. You're neither, you know, making the body comp changes you want to, or really fueling your training. And I think we've always just said, fuel your training and the body comp will come. But it's hard. We'll see how in the comments and stuff, but message right down below if you've had this, cause, this experience ever before. And it might not be orthorexia, you know, but these are disordered eating kind of things that we do where we feel guilty for eating when we know we need to eat more for a 200-mile gravel race. Like, that's pretty sure as much as you can. It's hard though, too.
Yeah.
And too, even if you know, I'm for Leadville, even if you know that you need to eat a lot, it's still hard, right? Mm-hmm. Just physically hard to eat all that food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's also, we don't have a full understanding of how this all works. And it's not as simple as calories in must equal calories out, because like our bodies as athletes they're very good at prioritizing how we use fuel and how we process it. And we're not really primed to just convert intake into fat right away. Like we are very good at storing it as glycogen and also just balancing, like, you know, when you're full, you know, when you've like, your body knows when is enough, I guess. And anyways, I'm talking in circles, but it's not as simple as I ate more today, I will gain weight. That's not actually how it works in practice. And the hole that you get into in these races, it would take you a lot to balance it back out. And there's a huge hangover. Like the hangover from Unbound is like easily a week where your metabolism is just absolutely revved. Anyways, I have fallen prey to this too. And my husband will tell you the day before a race, especially if I'm particularly nervous, which means that I'm in a vulnerable state, I will be like, I don't want to eat too much, but I know I need to eat more or whatever. And, it's a tough thing. It is a challenging thing, but one thing I'll tell you is that I have not weighed myself since 2021. I literally don't know what I weigh. I don't count any of the calories or macros that I take in, and somehow it works out and I perform okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to focus on it as much as we tell ourselves we do.
That's a great, great point. I think we're going to talk about with power meters too. For some people, they're not healthy and you can chase those numbers. And we're doing this red light, green light product to try to predict when someone's going to be overly fatigued and to prevent that from happening. And we have people submitting times they burnt out and why that happened. We put it in. So ChatGPT, I put it in ChatGPT to see, well, the top reasons people burn out. We got to publish this thing because there's like 15. It's amazing of all the ways that we mess things up. We've talked about every single one, but we're going to put in one video. But being obsessed with power numbers, where they're too high, their ego, my FTP is too high. So suddenly threshold is now VO2 max, you know, 105% of VO2 max. And you chase that number and you get focused on it when you know the feeling is wrong. It's like Michael Scott in The Office when it's like, turn right. And he's like, Dwight, we have to turn right. And he turns into a lake and then crashes. The machine tells us to do this. With Trainer Road too, if you're feeling bad on a day, please rest, like skip that day. Even if we told you to do a hard workout, you need to listen to your body. Know yourself too. I think Kaylee, what you're saying is you know yourself so well that some things aren't going to be good for you to see all the time. And it wouldn't be good to check your weight. You might check it 3-4 times a day and then impact your eating. And I know people have done it. I know I've done that too. I haven't weighed myself. And I haven't went for like a year without weighing myself. John, you've had this issue too before?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Get you obsessed with weight?
Yeah, in fact, it was Pete's idea originally. He said that he wanted to make a scale that's a blind scale that like you step on it and then you never see it, but it just like logs something in the background, you know? And then like, you know, if you really needed to, you could see it, but just having that display in front of you can be so damaging. And I easily lock into micromanaging every aspect of my body and start to think that I can do that, which in reality I can't. And it can spiral me pretty quickly. Something you mentioned, Ailey, that I really like is that you said that you don't do this enough. And that shows that you're like okay with the current state that you're in. And you know that over time, this is like in room for improvement, but it's okay that you're not there right now. Because a lot of the time on this podcast or from many other people in this world, you'll hear us talking about different situations and different suggestions. And you may not be, you know, quote, living up to whatever the standard is, but that is okay. And I think that mm-hmm. that was really cool and powerful for me to hear a pro athlete at the top of her game say, you know what, I can do better on this and that's okay. That was just really powerful. So I'm quite grateful that you had the courage to say that. So thank you. Yeah. This is a really hard thing with these longer events that I feel like a lot of people don't understand. These days, there's so many big races like Leadville, like Unbound, everything else. And when you do this in order to, It's different. You do have to fuel differently, and you do have to do a lot of these different things. And you can't just roll into it expecting it to be the same thing as when you go out and you do a weeknight criterium or something else like that. It's a very different game, and it requires even professionals to change up a whole lot like this.
Plus what Haley said, eating when you're nervous is so hard. And then those big races like Leadville, scared out of your mind, right? Before even just performing, but then for me, it's like crashing. Probably not for you too, but it's crazy how much the mental side impacts, but we really focus on so many. I mean, saying this with the power being your company or power training, we focus on the power, right? Some of the things that we can control that we can really see and touch. But then the mental side, maybe we could spend more time on that. And then I would actually have a better outcome, more enjoyable life. Which is, you know, the important part. Dude, I bet you, this is crazy, because a lot of people link winning to enjoyment. Like, I won't enjoy until I win. But if you could choose a cycling career where you just loved it the whole time, or a cycling career where you hated it the whole time, you'd probably choose the one you love, no matter what the outcome was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As long as you could pay the bills. But if the one that you hated, but you got paid $1 million a year, I bet you would, when you're 60, 70, you're gonna be like, I wasted my life. I hate that, right? You'd want to redo it and have that wonderful career. And that's why you guys do gravel. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah. I think, I mean, to get back to Alyssa's question a little bit, I think that is one of the things why gravel is exciting, is because it is different. It's so different from XCO. And there are some aspects of the training that are remarkably similar. I would say that the biggest thing with gravel and endurance mountain biking is the respect that's needed for how long it takes to recover from these events. And I'm at a level of like fitness and training age or athlete age now where I can recover from an XCO in like a day or 2 days and be okay. But to recover from these long events takes a week. And that means that you also need to have maybe a higher priority of rest leading into these events as well, just to make sure that you're not carrying chronic fatigue, which has been my issue the last couple of years, is I've struggled to balance the extra rest that is required to support this calendar, these style of events. So the biggest change, I suppose, in how you train is I need to be more diligent about my recovery. And I do also do a few more hours per year, and I would say that I do more threshold now. But other than that, it's a relatively similar training process as it was for XCO.
Haley, what has changed in your recovery for gravel? You mentioned you had to do something differently. And also, when you had the chronic fatigue, what symptoms were coming up that made you think, or like now looking back, what are the warning signs that you saw?
Mm-hmm. So what's different about recovery is that I just have to prioritize it more. I have to actually... I have to rest. And there are lots of different types of recovery, active recovery activities, but the biggest one for me is actually just resting. So when I'm not on the bike, I have to be very zen. I have to make sure that my sympathetic system is down regulated. I have to like be diligent about my mindfulness practice so that I'm upregulating the parasympathetic system. Yeah, I think it's just trying to breathe more and have more space in between, have more space when I'm not on the bike. I'm noticing that impacts all things, improves my sleep, improves my adaptation, all that kind of stuff. And I forget what the second part of your question.
Chronic fatigue. Question on that, really quick, before you go into the chronic fatigue, because you're a student currently. You also, as an athlete, have the responsibilities that are inherent with a professional athlete these days that pertain to social media and everything else. When you talk about getting more space, you know, down regulating that sympathetic side of things and up regulating the parasympathetic side of things, how do you balance all of that? Because that might be relevant for people listening to this that are students, are parents, are career professionals in one way or another, and athletes. Like, do you find that those things stand at odds with your ability to recover? And if so, how do you balance it?
So yes and no. I think you have to be very mentally disciplined with when you're on the bike, that's what you're doing. Your mental energy is just to you know, turning the pedals, doing the workout. And similarly, you have to be off the bike when you're off the bike mentally. I'm lucky that my school is mostly reading and writing about things that I'm interested in. So it's almost, in a way, leisure time. There are certainly days and weeks where it's quite stressful. And I think in those periods of time, I have to respect that load is load. And I've made the choice to be a student and to pursue graduate studies. And so it is a priority for me. And that means that sometimes my training load has to come down a bit to balance the school and the life load. And that's just the way it is. I'm still performing. I'm still achieving and chasing the goals that I want to achieve on the bike. So far, it's not harming things as long as I respect that balance. But to bring it back to the food thing, I am learning that if I'm adequately fueled, all of this is easier. I sleep better. My moods are way better. I have way less anxiety. Like, anxiety for me is definitely related to low energy availability. So I guess for me, the foundation actually is adequate and supportive nutrition, which allows me to have adequate and supportive sleep, which just makes all of this easier, balancing the stress and keeping the stress low way easier.
So when you look back, Haley, and you saw, well, you're chronically fatigued, what were the warning signs that, you know, maybe you could have changed things earlier, that you knew that you were getting fatigued? Now, looking in hindsight.
So a drop in power, a drop in peak power and ability to really hit it in those anaerobic zones and to do so repeatedly. That's a big one. Mood. So higher irritability and just like lower ability to cope with small stressors. So for example, this morning I was rushing to get out the door because I'm trying to beat this big storm that's coming to California and get my solid workout in. I had a VO2 workout today, so get that in before the storm hit. And as I was walking out the door, I heard a rattle in my rear wheel and I was like, oh no. And I had broken a spoke and there was a nipple loose in the wheel. And anyways, long story short, I had to fix that all in a very rushed way before I got out to do VO2 intervals, which are kind of stressful. And if I were in a period where I was carrying too much fatigue or I was underfueled or underrested, I would not have been able to deal with that. I would have been angry and irritated and like really frazzled. And instead, I was kind of just able to deal with it. So I guess that anecdote just to say that, yeah, resilience and mood trends are a huge red flag for me, or canary in the coal mine, if you will. And then sleep. My sleep definitely suffers. And I do use a wearable, a tracker that will, you know, show me deep sleep and REM sleep and sleep latency. And the latency for me is the biggest one. So when I'm carrying too much fatigue, it's pretty difficult for me to fall asleep. And it takes a long time for me to enter a deep sleep stage. But in the last like 6 months, since I would say that I've been coming out of this fatigue hole, those metrics are greatly improved. So that's, I think, something for me to watch as well.
Have you guys ever noticed that when you try to lose weight, that your partner just becomes a jerk? Like, it's like crazy. The same time,
everything around you.
I know, everyone's annoying. Like, it's just crazy how that happens.
Kind of morbid, but I spent so much of my life, like, the only way for me to get through this stuff is to laugh about it, because there are some things in life that are so serious you just have to laugh. But I spent so much of my life, my entire adolescence, most of my adult life thus far, in a state of semi-starvation. And I was so angry all the time, so angry. And it's only recently that like I have learned that there's actually stuff that I like, and I like to have fun, and I actually can have fun. And it's just such a freeing thing to know that all it took was just eating a little bit more and life was a whole lot better.
Yeah, there's that, what's that acronym where if you get distressing emotions, you say like, it's HALT, right? Are you tired, hungry? Now, what are the other ones? L and A, but angry, I forget what it is, but yeah. It's probably not that, but it's something that you should check, because so many times, like you said, things that wouldn't regularly bother you, the way that somebody's eating, right? Yeah. Like, suddenly becomes really annoying because you're one of those things, which is like to your point, if you're chronically fatigued, that's going to come up way more often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thing I forgot to mention as well, that's applicable for the women, is just your cycle. And my cycle's still not back online perfectly. After I kind of hit a low point at Tokyo with a descent into reds or in the lead up to Tokyo. Anyways, having a regular cycle is an indication that things are good. And if your cycle is not there, or if it's really, really irregular, that can be a sign of chronic fatigue, low energy availability, like a hormonal imbalance from overtraining. It's a really easy thing for us to notice. It may be a bit difficult for men when they don't have a menstrual cycle, but it's a really useful tool for assessing where you're at.
Yeah. John, just real quick, I looked it up.
Yeah.
HALT is hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Oh. And John, you just did an epic trip where you ran out of food and that worked out. Do you notice any, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about it, but John almost died. And then,
yeah, it was crazy. Sorry.
And then now you're sick.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
it's a rough week. Yeah.
Do you notice mood stuff too at the same time?
Oh, 100%. And, I think that you said load is load, Haley. And that's a really important thing to not overlook. When we're talking about, and when you say load is load, you're talking about all the different stressors in your life all contribute to the same pot, so to speak. And they're all different forms of stress, but when it enters the pot, it's stress. It is what it is. And your body kind of has a certain ability to tolerate that. And one of the main, I guess, supports for that tolerance is nourishment. And if that nourishment is dropped down, you simply can't handle as much load. So this is a lesson that I think I'll never learn. I feel like I learn it. And then I go through, 6 months later, I find myself in a situation where I think that for some reason I cannot nourish myself adequately, or I can tolerate insane amounts of stress and still do the same amount of training. And that's just not how it goes. And, it's funny. Haley, you've mentioned that you've listened to the podcast. You've probably heard us a lot of the time always talk, encourage people to consider lower volume training options instead of really high ones. And the reason that we do that is because of, just like you said, load is load. Like, I don't know what work and life will give me in 6 months. So I need to be open to adjust my training volume appropriately. So then that way, when I get to a difficult time period, I can adjust it. So just super. And I guess when we're talking about, let's bring it back to the question here from Melissa, when we're talking about going from a 90-minute race up to really long ones, that means that you have more load. That just is what it is. Like you said, you have to recover more, and you're going to have more tossed into that pot. So it's super important that people have that consideration. It's something you probably, especially as like a teenager, you really don't have to take into consideration to the same degree when you're doing something like XCO that isn't as tough. Super good insight there. Thanks, Haley. Appreciate that. Let's get into, I want to go into the next question here. This is from Chris. It's a really good one. Chris says, thank you for the many hours of keeping me company on long work travel. You've taught me a ton, and I feel like you're all part of my weekly group ride crew. It feels good, Chris. Thanks. Good to hear that. Chris says, after Coach Jonathan mentioned his struggles with in this last week's episode, I thought I'd reach out on how to help my 12-year-old son, Carter, stay motivated but not burn out. Over the past 6 months, Carter has really started to enjoy mountain biking. He rode bikes occasionally, like any kid would, and he'd occasionally go out with me, but recently he has gotten into it with his friends, and they are really getting into it fast. He has seen me train for years, and now he wants to do interval workouts. I feel like I should just encourage him to ride, but he really wants to do workouts. So what suggestions do you have for how to not kill his enthusiasm, but still keep it fun? This is like your intersection. Haley, this is meant for you. This is like what you're studying right now.
I was so excited when I read this question. I was like, I've been training for this. this is peak Haley time. But yeah, I don't know. Can I just dive in, or did you want to?
Please,
add?
Yes. Okay. And I'm going to have my ears attuned because this is relevant for me. So
a lot of the research in the lab that I am in is on specialization versus sampling. and the age at which it's optimal for those things to occur. When I say those,
what do those things mean?
Yeah. So yeah. Specializing in a specific one sport. So choosing to invest in one sport to the exclusion of others and go down the road of not necessarily elite performance, but an investment in a single sport. Whereas sampling is a phase of life where you're doing many different sports. You might be serious about some, but you're kind of trying things out and just staying diversified, I suppose. And right around like 12 to 14 is when you see kids start to specialize and have it be okay. That being said, there's a lot of nuance in there, with what is optimal, and it's sport specific and it's also kid dependent on what is going to be optimal for the kid. But I came up with three based on my education and personal experience. I kind of came up with three ideas for you because, well, first of all, the fact that it's coming from Chris's son is key. If the drive and the motivation is coming from the kid, you pretty much can't go wrong. It's when the drive and the motivation is being forced on the kid by either parent or a coach or something that you run into issues. So I give this advice with the foundational understanding that this is coming from Chris's son, Carter, and that's just a huge, huge positive. So my three pieces of advice, first would be to minimize the data. I don't think a 12-year-old needs a power meter. I don't think a 12-year-old needs really any data at all. It should all just be like...
What about S-Works? Just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
That is a whole nother thing as well. Anyways. Yeah, I don't think there needs to be any data at all, except if you want a stopwatch. I think that's a pretty key aspect of keeping the motivation high and the fun high. The second would be to keep any intervals game oriented. So, sorry, did you want to add something in there, Jonathan?
I want to ask something about the data side of things. And I don't know if you've ever looked into this or something else, but I don't think that kids can use Strava technically. I'm not sure what like the age cutoff is. I don't know. But I do know that like just riding around like local junior and or Devo organizations and stuff, I hear kids talk about Strava all the time. So they might just be like talking about it like a cultural thing that they don't take a part of, or they might be doing it. But Strava is an interesting one here because like if the kids are tracking, then that opens up like this kind of this weird and pretty like risky world for them to compare themselves to. Would Strava fall into that, what you're talking about of like trying to discourage them from doing that?
I know some kids under the age of 13 that use Strava and as probably maybe their parents' name, or with, you know, their parents have set up the account.
Mom and dad will get an extra.
I'd be scared right now.
Yeah.
In terms of service.
I do think that it sets the stage for some negative comparison or some toxic competition a little bit. I'm going to go off on one tangent here. So my thesis topic, the original research that I'm in the process of writing up that I will use to qualify for my master's degree is on parent-child co-participation in mountain biking. So looking at this very specific thing that seems to happen in mountain biking where parents and kids are kind of like teammates almost, or the most common, at least in Canada where we don't have NICA, it's like, kids start with their parents and they ride with their parents. And it's a really unique and positive thing where the parents are able to provide a benchmark for their kids that's not loaded with social comparison. So let's picture 12-year-old Haley goes out riding with her dad. I can use my dad as kind of like a stable benchmark to assess my progress against. And it's totally voluntary. It's like self-motivated, but it doesn't come with that, am I better than Susie, who I line up with every weekend to race against. So that's just a tangent, I guess, that's it's not related to one of my tips. But as a dad in this scenario, like you do have an active role that you can play to make sure that it's fun and positive for your son, I guess. So that first one, minimize the data, probably does include Strava, but I was more thinking about power numbers. I just don't. I see no purpose for them. And I think that could be an area that would lead to problems for someone so young. Second tip, keep it game oriented. So devise interval sets where it's like there's a loop. It's like kind of like you're racing against yourself. You can have that stopwatch if you want, and you can try to get self like assess against yourself and beat your own personal best. Other ways you can make it game oriented are to have like have technical elements in it, which actually leads me to my third point, which would be to largely keep the intervals off road. For someone so young, you're going to gain more by doing like a mixed surface or a fully trail interval where you have to integrate the technical skills required of mountain biking. There's a whole lot of things with mountain biking intervals, like the torque that's involved, the ability to ride technical under extremely fatigued conditions, a whole bunch of stuff. But I think that keeping those off-road makes those intervals feel like a game, and they're just a little bit more engaging and less about only physical suffering. I think the desire for physical suffering is very type 2 type of fun, and we develop that as we get older, but kids are not necessarily going to love that in the long run. So yeah, I guess those were my tips. Just keep the data at a minimum, try to make it a game in any way possible, and just mix up the intervals so that they're mostly off-road.
I have so many questions. We could talk about this for hours, and it would be like my own personal podcast. I probably wouldn't publish to the world, but one of the ways you mentioned keeping intervals fun, a really fun way that I've seen that done is relays with kids too. They have like relay teams, because if you think about it, like you set like a relay up and the kid's going to do like a hard effort and boom, interval done. And then you reset and redo the relay game again and keep it really fun. Like I remember seeing our local, at one point I remember them handing off a CO2, but then at other times it's like a teddy bear that doesn't quite fit in your jersey pocket. So you have to like smash it in there, and it makes it really fun for the kids, you know, to do that way. It's really, or they just like stuff it down their jersey and they have like, you know, a teddy bear flapping around and they're trying to decide. It's kind of silly. But that's like a really fun way that I've seen to make this happen. I have this question though, because so my son, you mentioned like riding with your kids and that benchmark thing. My son, he's only 7, and he's so discouraged when he rides with me because he's like, I'm not as fast as my dad, you know? And of course us standing back as adults, we look at that. We're like, well, that's so silly. You're 7 years old. You know, you haven't had those years of training, that sort of thing. But Is there a way that like parents can help so that when they are riding together, that point of comparison doesn't serve as a discouragement to them, but instead it's something that's more encouraging?
Yeah, I think from personal experience and from my studies, I would say that there's a couple things. One, when kids are pretty young and they're co-participating, most of the successful dyads that I have spoken to, the parent follows the kid. So whenever they're trail riding, it's the child that leads and kind of sets the pace and chooses the trails. So that just minimizes the competitiveness or the comparison there, because they can't actually see you riding something better than they might be able to ride it. And then the second aspect of it would be just trying to highlight any improvement or direct focus where you hope that it will go for your kids. If they do like ride a rock feature better than they ever have before, just making sure you point it out. So pointing out these successes and helping them work on that confidence muscle. You can tell a kid till you're blue in the face to like, just focus on yourself, but they're not going to listen. So I think, yeah, just trying to draw attention to their own successes and build the habit of being able to recognize your own improvement, because we're really bad as a general rule. People are really bad at recognizing things they've improved on. Yeah, I guess that would be my answer.
What do we, can we apply any of this to our adult social circles? Like, you know, we're talking about the parent-child context here, but what about just riding with friends? Looking at this, is there anything we can do to be a better friend to a person that we're riding with, or to help them? Or how should we view this relationship when we're racing and training with people that are faster than us?
I'd say it's the exact same. I think, I mean, when a parent and a child are out riding together, there's, you know, there, you can't shed all the elements of parenthood that are required, like responsibility and making sure your child is safe. But ultimately, you are a peer when you're out there, and how you would encourage your child to continue to enjoy mountain biking or cycling and continue to look for improvement or work towards improvement is exactly how you would do that for a friend, I would think. Like,
yeah,
I guess if I imagine the rides where I go with someone who is less skilled or a beginner cyclist, I typically will like let them lead, and I will provide a little bit of feedback or tips, but mostly just allow them to figure it out organically and highlight and praise when they've made those little breakthroughs on their own.
Yeah. What about helping them understand when it's too much? Because I've seen this sometimes with kids that at 12 years old, maybe Carter's like this, that just like wants to pick it up and go. Is there something like, how do you establish the bump? Or how do you put up bumpers in the bowling alley for the kids so they understand when they're doing too much?
I think on the spot on this one, I think that it is a lot easier to focus on positive additions as it is to focus on limitations or like borders is the wrong word, like limits, I guess. I think it's a lot easier to think about what things you can add to make the experience more positive, as opposed to what rules do you need to implement in order to make it, to limit the experience. So if Carter's only 12 years old, probably still encouraging other sport involvement, encouraging him to make sure that he's still hanging out with his friends and doing those things. And before you know it, if you've encouraged these other elements of his life to grow, then it's hard to overdo it, because you're encouraging balance in time dispersal, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to just say, you can only ride this much, or you can only do these many intervals, because maybe that's all Carter is focused on to the exclusion of everything else. So yeah, I think just expanding the attention as opposed to limiting the singular focus, limiting what he's allowed to do in that.
Cool. Great advice. Awesome. Thanks, Haley. Okay. And this next one is from they prefer to remain anonymous, so I won't read off their name. Say, hey, podcast crew, I'm a new listener to the podcast. I'm making my way back through previous episodes, particularly those that focus on mental health. I'm struggling with motivation for another season of racing. I love training, and for me, tracking my performance with numbers is highly motivating. Whether my performance is going up or down, I just like having a clear idea of where I am. And having been a competitive cyclist for more than 25 years through various phases of life that were busy or easy, I've learned to not beat myself up when my performance drops due to life circumstances. But I'm having a surprisingly difficult time getting motivated for next year due to the weight of external expectations. Last year, I had an incredible training year, resulting in the best performances I've had in 10 years, and as a result, I was on the state championships podium in 6 disciplines. Holy cow. Winning 4 of them. What a year, right? In the span of 6 months, I went from being just a fast guy to being the fast guy. Now, thinking of doing all these races I've done for years suddenly feels exasperating. I feel like I'll have failed if I don't match or beat last year. Even though my training is going very well, I know that sometimes life has ups and downs, so my actual performance may not match my fitness. Have any of you had a situation like this? And how do you get excited to race again without the weight of previous success holding you down? And I'm really obviously interested in Haley and your info on this, but Nate, I feel like
You just don't succeed.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah. There we go.
not the Olympics.
Yeah. Cuz
pretty easy.
Nate, you made your journey from Cat 5 to Cat 2 public. Like, you recorded all your races, you shared everything that you learned along the way. So you kind of did this too. So we'll get to Nate's opinions on this too, because I don't know if you feel this, but I certainly have experienced this. Haley, how have you managed it?
When I read this, I was like, yes, of course. Like, I identify with this like 1,000,000%. This is something that I went through in the lead up to Tokyo. So obviously there was a pandemic in there, but I basically qualified for the Olympics in May of 2019 when I got on my first World Cup podium. And that was probably the worst thing that could have happened, because I spent the next, it ended up being like 27 months because of the pandemic in there. But I spent the next 27 months trying not to fail, like trying to hold on to something that I felt like I already had, as opposed to chasing something that I hadn't yet experienced. And it was incredibly draining and demotivating and just like exactly what this person described. There's no joy there. There's no joy. And you do need some joy or some like motivation derived from that in order to continue to improve or to just be invested in what you're doing. Anyways, I will skate over most of my sob story, but after the Olympics, I got the rings tattooed right on my back. Like right where I felt the weight of them. I believe these are parallel, so I'm just kind of sharing my own experience, but the weight of success and the weight of the need to hold on to success, that's probably more accurate, can be debilitating and absolutely crushing. And that is what the Olympics kind of became for me. And so when I got this tattoo, it was a choice. It was a choice that I was going to view that journey as something that gave me wings, which is where my wings would have sprouted from, where I got my tattoo, as opposed to being this like really heavy weight. And so that's my first thing, I think, is that it's, you kind of have to choose the paradigm that you view it in. And it's a conscious choice and you have to kind of make it every day. And some days it won't feel like that. But that is one of the ways that I approach it. My second thing would actually be a question for this person, and it would be, why are you racing? Do you know why you're racing? What's the purpose of it for you? Is it to just win because you've won before? Or is there something that you're chasing? Because once you know what you're chasing, the motivation kind of takes care of itself. And that's a difficult question or a difficult conversation that I think you have to have with yourself to understand your why. But that's really where all the fuel comes from. I think it's the biggest thing. And if you don't know why, if you don't have that curiosity left, which was a big thing for me with my transition from XCO to marathon and gravel, there just wasn't room for curiosity there anymore. It was just heavy. It's okay to change it up. So, I mean, you're national champion across, or state champion across six disciplines. So we might have not, we might not have a new discipline to go to, it is okay to look for something where you do have curiosity. And I think it's really freeing when you can be an athlete in an environment where, it's just about what if, what might happen? And that's what motivates me, is like, I don't know what's possible. Let's see. And so I think it's okay to recognize that maybe you might need a change, and that's not a failure at all. It's possible that you might have exhausted what was available for you in that area.
That's a cool perspective on it. Thank you, Haley, for sharing that. Nate, how would you feel about this? Like, you aren't training. Let's just say that you like were going to go back into racing and everything else. Would you feel weight of expectation, or how would you manage this? Would you feel frustrated that you're not where you were?
No, I mean, my FTP right now is probably 180. Like, yeah, it is low, and I'm like, I'm like 210 pounds. It's pure muscle, of course, but it'd be fun. I think for me, the fun part would be I would go back pretty fast. So I'd never see that kind of rate of increase that you would doing that. And that would be fun. But people don't really have expectations on me for cycling. And even when I was winning stuff, I remember my first Cat 3 race, John was there. One listener was giving me tips on how not to get dropped on the crit. And then I won the crit on my first race. So that's like everyone. And then it was like, oh, but wait until this. And then I got upgraded to Cat 2. And then I had some big crashes on mountain biking, and I stopped. I didn't get to do a season, but you know, everyone's like, well, wait until you get to the 1-2 masters. And I I really wanted to win those, but I only got to do a couple, so it didn't happen. And I knew I wasn't going to do anything with P1-2. Those people are insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no chance. So there was no expectations on that either. So I guess, too, for me, level was, I think it was the opposite. People thought they didn't believe in me. So I was like, okay, I'll just do it myself.
A motivation for you to disprove him?
I don't know about a motivation, but it surely didn't put any pressure on me, right? Because if I didn't do well, everyone's like, Nate, you're a nice guy. Like, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I'm like, cool. Everyone's nice about it, right? No one's a jerk, which was very nice. That's it.
Can I want to share a personal experience with this one. So pretty early on in my mountain biking career, I got a podium at national championships. And I say career, I don't have a career, but then early on in mountain bike racing, I got a podium at national championships. The next year afterward, I completely felt what's being talked about here in terms of like, what do I do now? Like, I have to win, and that's like the only thing that I can do. And it was really discouraging. Following the advice of Haley here, I absolutely went the same route of finding out why I like to race. And it took me a while to figure that out. That meant I didn't race nationals that next year. I didn't have the motivation to go do it. And part of me was worried about the stress of going back and competing with the same level of expectation. And I wasn't up to managing that in that environment. And I needed to kind of step back. But I found like a different why for why I really loved to race mountain bikes. And since then, I don't feel any burden to live up to past results or expectations, and it's nice. But I'll share this. Forum user, I'm not sure what your name is. You were super rude one time. I remember on the forum you said, you were sharing feedback about the podcast, and you said, I don't listen anymore because none of them race. And I remember that was like after I had gone through the effort to record a podcast about me racing a stage race every single day of that stage race and sharing it. Like, and I was like, and I'd raced a bunch and I'd share all these things. And I remember somebody said they literally just did like 6 podcasts in a row showing like the racing. And I remember them saying like, yeah, but none of it's impressive. Like, and I Nate has mentioned this before, and I have too, like when you race and then it's out in front of a lot of people. Haley experiences this at a totally different scale. That adds a lot. And I think that from an outsider in perspective, if you know somebody that has achieved like a lot of success, and maybe it was a bit unexpected, maybe like in this case, or not unexpected, but unprecedented for this person, think about the ways that we're saying things that might add even more pressure and expectation onto those people. We can probably phrase things differently, and it would really help, you know? It means that we don't have to, when somebody performs really well, we don't have to ask them what's next. We don't have to go into a situation when they perform really well and say, where do you go from here? Or how are you going to do this again? We don't have to do those things. Those questions are probably already in their heads, you know? And when we say it, we like validate those really invalid questions that are going on. So from an outside in perspective, we can probably think about how we're being considerate toward people that have situations like this. And professional athletes, they have to be public on social media, and a lot of people just kind of share whatever their opinions are. And it's a good opportunity for us to think about what they're going through before we just jump in like that. So
you just triggered one very quick thing that I wanted to share. You brought up this memory, but I have always struggled with like performance anxiety or like, I guess, personal expectations. And one thing that my coach would always ask me when he could tell that I was getting really stressed out about like the workouts, because I need to be perfect so that I can race well. He'd be like, Haley, who was third at world champs in elite men last year? And I'd be like, I don't know. And he's like, yeah, no one cares. Like, you are the only one that cares. Like, as much as you think you might have expectations, it doesn't factor into anyone else's life, really. So you got to figure out why you're doing it for you and do it because you enjoy it. Because no one else is thinking about it.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah. Great example. Well, cool. Nate, I know that you're low on time. Haley, we're also taking up the allotted time that we had with you. We have one more question that we'll just get to the next time we have you on, Haley. If you're willing to do that, it'd be awesome. If you enjoyed having Haley on in this podcast, let us know. There are YouTube comments down below. You can tell us on Spotify as well if you're listening there. You can go follow Haley, Haley Hunter Smith. It's middle name, not last name, as we discussed before we started recording. You can go follow Haley, and I would encourage you to do that. Haley, I appreciate how open you are on sharing your journey through sport and all the things you learned to that intersection of your studies and sport. It's super great. Thanks for doing it. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Sorry, I was a little long-winded on the answers, but I appreciate it.
Oh, no.
If we cover one question, that's great. That's all that matters because okay. It's quality. Yeah, yeah. No, not at all.
No, appreciate it's informative. It. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks a bunch, Haley. Take care.
Thank Bye-bye. You.